Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I see there's still a few people coming in upstairs. Good morning, good morning. Please join us. I promised last night that we would try and join on time, so that's what we're doing. I know there's a very interesting little bookshop that's been put up outside. That's why I think there's a few people still perusing, but let's try and begin on time. Anyway, welcome to the first full conference day of this third annual Austrian Forum for Peace. For those of you who did not meet me last night, my name is Damita Pressel, and I'm delighted to guide you through the conference once again. Our topical focus for the day is the transatlantic drift. The fact that Europe is becoming increasingly estranged from a United States that is increasingly disengaged from the international community, which of course causes a leadership vacuum in the areas of peace and human security. We have a panel debate on this transatlantic drift coming up now this morning, after which we have several workshops planned running in parallel from 11 to 12:30 and 1:30 to 5 with a lunch break in between. Now, hopefully everyone already knows which workshop they are participating in. Let's see some nodding heads here. I see a few nods. Wonderful. If you are uncertain regarding the room in which your workshop will take place, you will find plans to guide you just outside the conference hall, so you can check there. And because the weather gods are on our side, the entire week lunch will be served in the courtyard at 12:30. For those of you not joining a workshop, we're happy to offer you a guided tour through our museum and the exhibition Schleining and Peace. The tour starts at 3 p.m. and it offers a comprehensive insight into the Austrian Center for Peace, its origins, its work, its methodology, spanning from its founding in the 1980s to the conflicts of our current time. And you can find the museum as you enter the castle. It will be the first door to your left. So the same door that takes you to the museum shop also takes you to the museum and to the tour if you're interested. After the workshops and the tour end, there will be another public panel tonight on how Europe can deal with Russia given Washington's disengagement at 5:30, which we hope you'll join us for. It'll take place in German, but there is simultaneous translation available, and we have some brilliant speakers joining us for the session. Dinner will be served also in the castle courtyard tonight between 7 and 8. And of course, if you have any questions at any point, please don't hesitate to find one of the organizers. We're always happy to help. Now, having covered the organizational details, let's dive right into today's topic, the transatlantic drift. As the United States are increasingly focused on their own interests, who will lead on peace and human security? Can Europe take the lead? And if so, how? And what role can civil society and international organizations take on? We hope to elucidate all of that on this next panel, and I will be handing over the stage to your moderator for the session. She is a seasoned Austrian diplomat, formerly the permanent representative of Austria to the United Nations in Vienna, as well as the former Austrian ambassador to China, Mongolia, Brazil, and Suriname. Please give her a very warm welcome, Irina Gina-Reichel.
Good morning. Well, it's a great pleasure for me to moderate this panel. I have four wonderful speakers, and I would like to invite them to come up the floor. I will introduce them later on as they take the floor for the first time, and you will also be able to find their biographies in the conference material. Wolfgang Petritsch, Oliver Richmond, Farah Bdur, and Bettina Muschat. Please do come up to the stage. Wherever. Yes, wonderful. Yes, well, the question that we have been asked to address is who will lead on peace and human security? And our wonderful moderator, Damita, she already pointed to the difficulty that is brought into the international setup through the disengagement of the United States from Europe. But that's not the beginning of the difficulties that Europe is experiencing in the overall setup of international relations. For a long while, Europe was very proud to be not only an economic integration organization, but also a factor for peace and stability in Europe, creating a big space of peace and security in Europe. As of late, especially in the neighborhoods of Europe, the situation is not so rosy anymore. And the challenge to Europe is to position itself in a new international context. And this new international context is characterized by a number of issues that I'm sure we are going to come into our conversations. So I'm not going to preempt what our distinguished speakers will say. The setup for our conversation is that I will ask each one of our panelists to start us off with a little introductory statement of their main positions. And then we hopefully can go into an interactive exchange here on the panel. But we would also very much welcome participation from you all in our audience, our distinguished participants here. We have microphones to facilitate your participation. And so, you know, be ready and willing to engage. We are going to make this as interactive as possible. With that little introduction, let me turn to you, Wolfgang, as our first panelist to take the floor. Wolfgang Petritsch, of course, is a seasoned diplomat, very involved in the peace processes of Dayton, very involved in the Middle Eastern situation, in the what we call the Western Balkans, very involved also in terms of reflecting on international relations and what our work as diplomats can mean. Wolfgang, you have looked at how Europe finds itself these days in terms of the neighborhoods, the challenges very much in the vicinity of Europe. And perhaps you would like to elaborate a little bit on that point in your first intervention.
Okay, thank you very much, Irene, for introducing me. And I think this is, of course, a very interesting panel. We always say interesting when we don't know what it actually is. I would like to talk first about two topics, so to speak, about the alleged transatlantic drift. This is what the conference and this morning is all about it. And then also about where, as you said, where Europe really is. Now, about the transatlantic drift, really, I think this is very much overestimated as a surprise. It is not a surprise, of course. And I remember when I was working in New York in the 1980s, we were talking about the widening Atlantic, meaning Europe and the United States are moving apart. Yeah? Well, what we see today, of course, has a new quality in terms of what it means to drift apart. But it is not something that has started just yesterday or in 2017, in the first Trump administration. I believe that Trump is more the symptom for something than the one who has moved really into a direction which has surprised us. Europe in many ways was seen as a sort of a sleeping continent, and that clearly refers to the fact that Europe after 1945, with the United States, has learned its lesson. The continent, which was over many hundreds and hundreds of years involved in European civil wars, let me put it this way, has decided again with the help and with the support and more than just support of the United States to change. Yeah? And this period, I believe, comes to an end now. The United States, and it is not just Mr. Trump, considers the European Union is a threat for its transactional policies, particularly in trade, but also in all the other areas that we have. In fact, I believe this is no less than a cultural revolution which is taking place in the United States, and this is hitting Europe. And you see this in a very small, is a very small part of it, is that the Trump administration, its vice president, they openly support the right extremist populist parties in Europe. They are becoming the new normal in the relationship between the United States, between the Trump administration, to sort of narrow it in, and the European Union. This clearly is the biggest challenge that Europe's society, Europe's post-1945 society and politics are now involved. But as I said, this has not started just recently. I reread a book from 2003, which was famous at the time, and the Europeans were all kind of laughing about it, written by Robert Kagan, who writes about how the United States and Europe are actually not even moving apart. There is no drift. There is already a fact that has been established. And he writes, it's time to stop pretending that Europeans and Americans share a common view of the world. A very dramatic statement, which in 2003, of course, connected with the Iraq war, that actually tells you where we are, but not since, as I said yesterday, since a long time. Yeah? And of course, it is, they say, and Kagan goes on to state that he doesn't even know whether they, Europe and the United States, actually occupy the same world. Now, how does this world for Europe look like? And there is now, and I'm moving from culture, from trade to geopolitics. Europe is, for the first time ever in its long history, in a situation where on all four corners of the continent, there are wars, crises, challenges, you name it. In the east, we know Russia, Ukraine. In the south, we have southeast, we have the Middle East. We have Africa in the south, only associated with negative implications for Europe. Migration, of course. The countries there which are collapsing or becoming. Then we move north. Since many years now, since the climate change has become a factor, there are now new sea routes in the north, of course, privileging Russia and opening up the resources of the Arctic for the world, so to speak. But who and which world are we talking about? Here, this is actually the wider context of the Greenland aspirations of Mr. Trump. Yeah? So in the north, we have a huge challenge, yeah? Because of these economic strategic implications. But now, and this is the really new situation, the west, the Atlantic, where we still sort of believe it's only drifting. It's much more. The Atlantic has become now enemy number one, so to speak. Why? because the challenge for Europe, which, as I said, is built upon these transatlantic relations and the principles and the philosophy and everything positive that you can say about Europe since 1945, has come via the Atlantic to Europe. This is now obviously gone. Maybe some things will come back, but I'm afraid if we now do not realize that Europe, and this is my last message, if now we do not realize that we need to get our European act together, it's going to be a big problem for us.
Thank you very much, Wolfgang. I think a lot of points that you made we will probably come back to also in the wider discussion. You're painting a picture where Europe is surrounded really by problem areas, and I would certainly hope that to the south the relationship with the African continent is also a possibility for new cooperative endeavors. But as you said, the perception very much is also a negative one, often in terms of migration and so forth. So we will probably have to come back to that issue as well. This Europe that is encircled more or less by problem areas, neighborhoods that are not peaceful the way they used to be, or openly at war, or not friendly towards Europe anymore. How, in that kind of a situation, can Europe lead on peace, if that is the aspiration that we still have? I'm turning to Professor Oliver Richmond, who you have written on the peace architecture quite a bit, the global peace architecture. And from our preliminary conversations, I know that you have some ideas about how to improve that peace architecture, or you wish to expose some of the shortcomings of that peace architecture. Please, go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you, and lovely to be here and to see you all in this wonderful place talking about very important things. On thinking about peace in international politics and in the European region, I think we need to try to connect it with the very latest scholarship and thinking first in order to assess the practices. And I think we have been in the habit in international politics and international relations and in social sciences more generally, and certainly in the policy world, of operating within very comfortable conceptual categories: the state system, regionalization, integration, and imperial or global interests, if you want to take a historic perspective. And I think when it comes to peace and the very latest thinking and scholarship and practice around the world on peace, from local peacemaking to regionalization and to global thinking about peace, such as we see in the Sustainable Development Goals, the Sustaining Peace Agenda, the Common Agenda, the New Agenda, and whatever you want to call it, the kind of UN thinking about peace, you're starting to see the breakdown of these old categories. And I regard the debates that we're having about whether Trump or Europe and which way will things go, geopolitics back to authoritarianism, authoritarian capital, tech capital, oligarchs and warlords returning under all of those rubrics, it's very retrogressive. This is conceptually retrograde. And in policy terms, we're being pushed into very retrograde modes of thinking. Once again, I mean, we're being forced to take seriously geopolitical, state-centric, regional, and imperial interests as if they were being dragged out of the dustbin of history. I don't think that works. It's the same with the divisions between North and South. Where do we find the latest thinking and practice? Do we find it in the global south? Do we find it in the global north? Which bits of those? I mean, I don't think this works conceptually. So in order to address your question, which I think is very important, I think the first thing is to think about is what is the latest scholarship? And how far you are from the dustbin of history really probably is connected to what the latest scholarship or the gap between your policy, your standing, your approach, and latest scholarship, in which these categories have all broken down. They don't work, and you can empirically see they don't work. And that's why we're being dragged back into these geopolitical discussions about whether the EU or the US and so on and so forth. I think that when it comes to this kind of conceptual innovation, the EU and the policy and scholarly thinking around this conceptualization is the last man standing when it comes to peace at the moment. And that's because these categories are open to a very large degree. So there's space to think beyond the state, to think beyond this kind of individualistic, capitalistic, techno-oriented power politics that's emerging from that kind of discourse. The US and a lot of its scholarship hasn't avoided the trap of going back to these old categories, and so has lost trust, and most importantly, probably lost future trust around the world. And I think that's highly problematic. The EU hasn't quite got to that point yet. So the scholarship is telling us that peace can't be just equated with victory or the balance of power or conflict or crisis management, but has to go much deeper than that, has to be equated with justice. In the 1960s, we knew about social justice from Galtung, and today we're thinking about equating peace with global justice, which brings in its various dimensions, historical justice. How many peace processes, how far did peace building or peacekeeping connect with historical justice and achieve historical justice? Generally, it didn't. Distributive justice, how far did peace practice connect with the idea that material resources and capacities and knowledge had to be redistributed around the planet? It did a bit, but it has a very long way to go. Gender justice, well, it's on the table for the first time in peacemaking. Is it being implemented? Well, that's very doubtful. Environmental justice, on the table. Is it being implemented through these peace strategies? It's not. And then racial justice, probably at the moment one of the most controversial, because it brings up these big questions about historical compensation and the ways in which the hierarchies of politics, its categories, and the global political economy are loaded against the former colonies of the global north. Do peace processes deal with these? Very slight degree. So you can see we've got a long way to go, but you can see that the scholarship is pointing in these directions, whereas the kind of mediatized discourse about international politics, which point to Trump and China and Russia and Ukraine and Syria and so on, Gaza and so on, read these things through these very old-fashioned categories where there is no peace, there's no way forward other than the balance of power, the reassertion of nationalism, of sectarian interests and identities and these sorts of things. They're self-replicating discourses that I don't think really help us. The EU dragged itself out of this hole, conceptually and in practice. It's a marvelous and historic achievement. All of the participants in those world wars and global imperialism, and all that went with it, slavery and racism and all those sorts of things, began to try and turn it around conceptually and break out of it. So what does that mean? And I'll finish just with a couple of comments about that for the global peace architecture and the way in which we think about peace. I think we have to move away from those old categories through which we understand democracy and human rights, the rule of law and so on. I mean, these are necessary things, but we now need to rethink and extend and improve. And we have to think about them in different ways. A key thing which I think comes from the peace with justice scholarship, which I think is leading the field in many ways, and for policymakers, you need to get close to that because other policies will tend to be short-term and possibly fail. So transversal understandings of power, you know, historically power has organized things for us from the top down. But what we've seen since World War II and beyond is we've seen that thinking practices, policies that stick, often reverse that. They often put the weakest first in any peace or systemic reform. Mobility. I mean, we talk a lot about migration as if it were a problem, and it's causing populism and nativism and nationalism and so on and so forth. But conceptually, it's a problem because it shows how modern political structures can't deal with the world, the modern world, and its forces and dynamics. Mobility is a key one. It's essentially becoming to be seen around the world as a right. And I can go on. There's more conceptual breakthroughs that we need to make, which need to be transported into policy and into the structures and infrastructures and architectures of the world which make peace. And don't forget that peacemaking is central to world order. Without it, world order is in a constant state of collapse, rebirth, collapse, which is a kind of cycle we need to deal with. So my message is that I think the kind of European experience has taught us an awful lot, and we're still quite close, I think, to this scholarship. I think these categories of North, South, US, China, Russia need to be broken down. There's an awful lot of critical thinking about peace from all of those zones where we all agree. So these are artificial divisions to a large degree. And we need to be very wary about applying these historic categories to future international relations as we rethink in this transition.
Thank you very much, Oliver. I think you opened the... you opened our perspectives in a very, very important way, and by bringing in this approach of peace with justice, I mean, this is obviously something that cannot be achieved through the kind of transactional policy that is now being practiced by the Trump administration, and which the European Union in a certain way very unsuccessfully tries to emulate now. No, I mean, we are now moving a little bit in the direction of also wanting to do transactional international relations, leaving aside our values systems to a large degree, and leaving aside the knowledge that we have built up institutionally about systemic approaches. So that brings us to the question, of course, you know, how can the European Union position itself, building on that those insights and that historical record of the European Union in this new context, and how is the European Union doing it in particular regional contexts? And I'm turning to you, dear Farah Abdur. You are an expert of the region. You come from the region, coming from Jordan, and have worked on issues of the Middle East for a long time, both for an institute in the United States, but also locally. What is your take on this issue, now that the stage has been set by the two gentlemen?
Thank you, Irene. Before I begin, I just want to thank the Austrian Peace Forum for the warm welcome. It really touched my heart. When we're talking about the future of the European leadership, especially in conflict zone like the Middle East, I don't think we can assess this role in separation of the future of the American leadership role on a global level. And this is something that Wolfgang, you know, touched upon. Yes, we all know that the seed for disengagement has been planted many years ago. Since the Obama administration, basically all American presidents recognized the need to shift the scarce military resources out of Europe and into Asia, and they all wanted the NATO allies to do more and to share more responsibility when it comes to their own defense. However, no previous administration was willing to pay the political cost for doing that. Now, with the second Trump administration and with the president's unconventional, unorthodox leadership style, he's doing that, and he's doing it very fast. Yes, in less than 2 years, we are going to have a new administration in office, and this administration might reverse elements of Mr. Trump's foreign policy. They might reinstate foreign aid. They might restaff international institutions. They might show greater warmth to the NATO allies. But I find it hard to imagine that once the resources have been shifted out of Europe and into Asia, I find that any president, Republican or Democrat, will shift these back in. So this is to say that when we're thinking about this issue, I think it's a mistake to see it through the lens of post-Trump restoration. United States is changing, and it's changing very fast. They will prioritize their national interest, and they going to push more from the allies in Asia and in the NATO to do more. And with that, I would say it is fair to predict that we are going to witness more tension in the future between the United States and its allies. I think this is where the foreign policy in the United States going to shift, and the United States going to transform from being a wholesale security provider into a security enabler. And with that shift, I think it's also fair to assume that there will be humble emphasis on values like human rights and democracy, and there will be a greater focus on shared interest and shared principle. And with that, we could predict that the non-democracies around the world will have a greater role in the alliances that it's led by the United States. So this is to say that the future of the alliances, global institutions, treaties, is going to look drastically changed and different from the one that we already know. And that, again, I'm not saying that this is necessarily a bad thing, but I'm saying that we need to be prepared for that change. And for me, the way I see it, looking from the region, it will open the door for Europe and other players in the world to assert themselves. It is an opportunity. There is the space and necessity to reimagine their role in the region. When it comes to the Middle East, I would say that Europeans should focus on two things. And who am I to to give advice for the Europeans? But I'm just trying to give the image from the region. I think first and foremost, the Europeans should assert their interest, and this is something was tapped upon by previous speakers. If the United States is being transformed from a security provider into a security enabler, then why not Europe will also evolve from being a passive donor into a strategic and deliberate architect of peace, like what Oliver was talking about. But in order to do that, there's a lot of, I would say, homework has to do, especially when it comes to the decision-making within the European Union, which makes the European Union more passive and crippled when it comes to issues that it is very important, whether we're talking about immigration, fueling extremism, the disruption of fuel and energy markets, all of that. But in the past 2 years, I think Europe did a lot, but there was no really tangible effect on the ground. For example, it's pledged to pay $120 million for the humanitarian aid in Gaza. They issued statements in order to achieve ceasefire. They called for the respect of the international law, but at the end of the day, there was no strategy, and there were no deliberate and consistency in doing that. Also, the credibility of Europe in the past 2 years took a hit, a fatal hit, whether we're talking among Arabs or Jews at the same time. So the framing of the relationship between Europe and the region should be something that should be reflected on. I don't think it should be shared on values or principles. I know it's very hard for me to say that, but I think this is the reality. It should be shared on, it will be framed on shared principles and shared interests. Investing in the stability of the Middle East is actually investing in the security of Europe, just having this framing around that. And of course, Europe has many tools. It has the leverage, it has the economic clout, the military power, and the legal framework and institutions to empower those in the region who serve Europe interest. And I'm refraining from using any labels like moderates, spoilers, all of these terms. Just invest in the people in the region and the parties in the region who serves Europe interest. And this has to go through a very hard conversation about the decision-making mechanisms within Europe. The other thing, and I will end with that, Europe should also support the regional initiatives when it comes to peace. We know that recently the Arab states, especially Saudi Arabia, the center of gravity in the region, the power gravity in the region is being in the Gulf, and especially with Saudi Arabia, they launched the Global Alliance for the Recognition of the Palestinian State. This is something that of course, it's very controversial in Europe, and and there is a lot of, I would say, philosophical questions about how do you give recognition for the state when, in reality, there is no state, and all of that. And then there is the, I would say, conflict within the European countries around that. But if the regional countries are telling you that the path to achieve peace is actually by recognition of the Palestinian state that opened the path for negotiation instead of starting with negotiations and end with recognition, that's what will bring stability to the region. I think it's something that should be considered. And listen to, you know, only 14 out of 27 countries in the European Union recognize Palestine, and we need more. And again, once the framing with the region has been shifted away from values and human rights, and we're saying that we need to do this in order to save our interest, I think that will influence the internal dynamics between the European countries. So I will end with that. I think Europe should assert its interest, understand that going through a very deep and sometimes painful conversation about the decision making and support the regional initiatives because that's what the region wants.
Thank you very much. Yeah, very, very important points that you're making, Farah. You know, the focus on the interest that Europe should have and that interest that dovetails with interest of countries in the region. To have stability in the Middle East, I think it's a very strong, you know, argument that transcends the discussions about values and procedures, etc. And you also made the point that the European Union, in order to seize this opportunity which presents itself in the current geopolitical constellation, in order to seize that opportunity, European Union needs to do its homework. And I'm turning to Bettina now, because in our conversations preparing for this panel, I know that you reflected a lot about the need for the European Union to do its homework, and you're doing that on the basis of your rich experience as a representative of the European Union in various countries such as Yemen and Nicaragua and Libya. And so you're speaking from experience, really. Bettina,
yeah. You have the floor. Well, I'd like to sort of widen our horizon a little bit with respect to the question of, can the EU lead in international peace efforts, and of course the homework issue. So you also saw probably how the E3, that's the UK, France, and Germany, plus the EU, met with the Iranians, the Iranian foreign minister in Geneva, and then, as we know, the joint attacks started on Iran, and the US dismissed the EU's efforts as unlikely to be helpful ending the Iran-Israel war. So that certainly was a bitter reality check, at least as it was picked up certainly by the German press and commentators. And the EU, key architect of the previous Iran agreement, the JCPOA, learned the hard way that the adage, as long as negotiations are ongoing, nobody is shooting, does no longer apply. And its efforts had come in vain. And then a few days ago, the US, with one stroke, so it looked like, managed to end 30 years of conflict between Congo and Rwanda, responding positively to Congo's request for mediation. The EU has its diplomatic service, part of colonial history, envoys, delegations on the ground. To pick one more example, the Sahel region, the EU and its member states have lost ground over the years. You, as observers, all know this. So we accept that peace mediation moves usually slowly, but here we've seen some very rapid and somehow to be seen whether effective or not actions. We cannot escape the need for introspection. And so I'd like to turn to the hope work the EU will need to do, because we haven't spoken about this beyond the decision making. And of course, I'd like to preface this and say perhaps this extraordinary crisis, and I see it as being a all grown up as a transatlanticist, even back home, just returned now from the trip to the US. Perhaps this crisis also means, as famously, opportunity to forge the European project internally, becoming more united and strong before we project our ambitions abroad. And that would perhaps also help the Middle East. We note, many of us perhaps here in a such a peace project like this institution with a degree of apprehension that we spoke about 2%, 3.5%, 5% defense spending. All of this is to counter the U.S. Possibly quite correct perception that we had outsourced security to them and then built up these luxurious welfare states in our own borders, with round borders, and having a cozy time. And obviously the EU is then not being taken very seriously, it seems. So we should be vigilant, I think, with respect to all these spending targets, not because they're not good per se, but they could possibly hide that we are simply not joined up underneath. I looked at, there are plenty of studies and they give you plenty of figures, but these studies suggest that the cost of non-cooperation in defense spending could range from 18 to 57 billion per year. I could elaborate for hours about everything I read. We are simply not effective if we continue the way we've done it, with a very split up defense market. In 2020, I read here, 80% of procurement and more than 90% of research and technology, which of course precedes any real security strengthening, are run on a national basis. That simply cannot work any longer. There needs to be a very different approach when it comes to securing us jointly. And then, there's of course deployability of equipment. The list is very long, and I just wanted to sort of to tick you off and go and research in that respect. I think we should hold our national governments and the EU collectively accountable to not just spending targets, but to genuinely depart from the notion that a country can do it alone. It needs a very, very different, it needs us leaving behind comfortable, beloved national interests in that field, because this time round, it's vital. The internal market is another field where I think we can do much more. I had not looked at that until we had the Draghi report, and that was really reading us, I would say, the riot act in many respects, because it just pointed to the fact that despite Jacques Delors and all the other fathers of European integration, we are certainly starting from a different level, otherwise we wouldn't have an internal market, but we are actually sliding back in some respects. Again, here, if we don't take this now very seriously and move forward, because it is vital to back our increased expenditure, for example, in defense, by consolidating what we have and also protecting something that in the previous commission, we even had a commissioner who was the commissioner for the European way of life. And, you know, At the time I thought, that's a bit of an odd title, but now I really think, yes, we have something very deeply to defend the European way of life, and it is much more than what perhaps an American observer would suspect this can be. It means that we can keep up our welfare states and protect, contrary to the US, those who are vulnerable. But that we can only do this if we consolidate and we become honest about the need to make our small little fiefdoms that, you know, somewhere if you look big picture, member states in some respects can still seem, you know, I've just read 6,000 regulations prevent the free movement of people, you know, professional recognition of titles, etc., across borders. And this is rising. So just examples to make you, to invite you to read more about these issues. And then, of course, I go to the Vexit topic, always thinking when and how can the EU again project itself credibly abroad of the lack of unanimity and the value issues, everything that, Farah, you particularly pointed at. We will need to come to terms with the fact that we cannot get our act together when it comes to even the most egregious violations of our values and then call it such. I'd like to even quote one member here of this conference who told me, summing it up, after October 7th, which requires unequivocal condemnation, the EU lost its moral compass. Well, you know, it's something that we have to just reckon with and actually, we cannot dismiss it. And I, of course, I come from a country where such debates are particularly difficult and thorny. So finally, let me conclude by coming to some nuts and bolts. I think until 2023, and it's worthwhile recalling this, the US provided $65 billion US dollars of official development aid, as categorized by the DAC. It was a third of global aid. However, the EU and the member states, it's $96 billion collectively. So that is obviously much more than the US. The EU has already said, and you know, I picked up some voices, we cannot rescue and become sort of now the rescue of last resort for what has happened, although the changes in some respects are very dramatic, dramatic impact in the global south. But we also need to reflect now that cuts are coming our way in development aid. I see the next multi-annual financial perspectives are going to see cuts. And so we need to, in the EU institutions, to think, how can we become much more effective? We are slow, and a friend, a very keen observer of Central Asia, told me about the Five Nations Railway Project, connecting various improbable destinations of connectivity with China. And this includes railway lines in Afghanistan, taking that also to hubs to Central Asia, and they have started building. And of course, there is a question, the global gateway is very important, but I also see that some critical voices say, where's the impact, where's the direction? Of course, countries may have a choice and say perhaps the EU is applying values like environmental issues and others, but we have to become much faster. And that, I think, is something that I've seen. I've been for 35 years in development aid. I mean, unless we come faster and are better in communicating and get all our different ducks into the rope in between the member states and us, you know, this conversation is lost on far afield countries when they see that China builds a railway and simply does it. So, I conclude by simply saying that unless we get this all rounded up and then review also how we deal with our values and how we project them abroad, I cannot see the EU playing a very strong role as a peace mediator abroad. And obviously, I think many countries look to us and hope for the EU to precisely become this, because they look still at the EU as a project of values and unprecedented peace in the world.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bettina. Well, this was a very interesting opening round, and there are a number of elements that came out of the statements that I would like to pursue a little further in the coming minutes. I would also like to invite you, our distinguished audience, to actively think with us, and feel free to ask for the floor if you want to come in. The shift away from Europe, Wolfgang, that you said happened, of course, a long time ago. I totally agree with you. And one of the reasons, of course, why the United States shifted away from Europe is because they turned more attention to the Pacific, and in the Pacific, of course, there is China, and the competition between the U.S. and China is an element that cannot be overlooked. At the same time, China has been developing a lot of global initiatives. Bettina, you mentioned briefly the attempt of the European Union to extend the global gateway approach to Central Asia, etc., and in other areas of the world. But China was doing that earlier with the Belt and Road Initiative, starting as early as 2012. When I was in China, I saw it happening right there. And they have followed up with a number of global initiatives around development, around civilization, around other issues that go close to what I heard you say, Oliver, about peace and justice, you know, this issue of justice. Of course, we can discuss whether the Chinese approach brings us closer to justice the way we understand it, but the intention, I believe, is there to have that in the perspective as well, and of course we have the developments with BRICS and BRICS Plus, which start to be much more than they used to be in the past. They are no longer only a loose group of countries that comes together every, you know, year once for some summit. They act in a much more structured way and bring a lot of weight in terms of demography, in terms of influence in various regions together. So when we position the European Union with all the shortcomings that you pointed out, Bettina, but with all the potential also of the history and the record of the European Union so far, when we position the European Union in this wider context, where do you see the opportunities for building new partnerships for peace, for building up confidence again in a situation where I believe the European Union also is still a bit shocked by the quick changes that occurred, and perhaps has lost a bit of its own confidence in doing what they actually could be doing, So where do you see opportunities? Where can we go back to history one way or another to draw on what has worked in the past, adapt it, you know, bring in the new concepts, Oliver, that you mentioned, which are not so new concepts. You know, peace and justice have been around, at least in some traditions, Catholic social teaching for a very, very long time. But apply them to the realm of peacemaking also, and thereby strengthen the role of the European Union. That would be my small little question for the second round of this of these interventions. Who would like to? Yeah, Oliver, please.
So as you were speaking, I kind of mapped out a few quick responses, and these are them just very quickly. First, we need a mediator for a multipolar world. We don't have one. The Security Council is deadlocked. So there's an opportunity. Secondly, integration has to be thought of within global perspectives in response to north, south, east, west divisions, not just in regional perspectives. You know, an easy start would be to think about Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea. You know, those sorts of opportunities are already, I think, in play, aren't they? From these geopolitical conflicts that are emerging or are ongoing, there are a lot of developmental and humanitarian human security issues which need to be responded to. The UN isn't being very successful in responding to them. The donor system is deadlocked. Who will respond? Another opportunity. This is the fallout of 21st century geopolitics and geoeconomics. Fourthly, producing new knowledge. Who's going to do it? If your academy is anchored in national and regional interests, as we see in China or Russia, and increasingly now in the US, who is free to produce the knowledge that's required to respond to these kinds of problems? Well, we have a space here. I think my colleague here raised a very important point about rethinking diplomacy and the peace tools associated with peacekeeping, mediation, and also citizen-based approaches to conflict in the context of the new environment, which operates at a much greater pace, speed, networks, transversality, mobility. I mean, these are the characteristics of successful diplomacy and therefore of peacemaking in modern environment. And this brings us back to the old points that you raised, you know, the iterations of various historical relationships between peace and justice. Who can close that gap? You know, will be the mediator, the successful peacemaker, which shapes the next phase of world order. And the key thing is to remove the utility of violence as a political tool. China, Russia, and the US are putting the utility of political violence back on the table as a political tool right now, and not just them, but many other states, regional actors around the world too. And you know, the goal, I guess, of the EU and of it in its various iterations over time, including Britain and with Britain out and so on, has been to mitigate, subdue, and to remove the utility of political violence as a tool of politics by using various tools, whether they are direct tools of peacemaking or institutions, constitutions, the rule of law, regional strategies, international law, international institutions, and so on and so forth. And the, you know, political violence is kind of blowing out of those constraints again. And we need to think where we have space to think about how to get control of that phenomena. And here, I think, is a good space. Very difficult to do it when you're under such acute pressure, whether it's top-down authoritarian pressure or the pressures associated with scarce resources and environmental disaster and so on and so forth, or war around the world. So there are, I think, five or six opportunities there for us to be thinking through.
Thank you. Yes. Let me also turn to the audience and recognize if I see any questions.
Well, let me refer to some of the points that were made, and Oliver, you rightly referred to the new concepts, new old concepts of peacemaking. The big structural question is whether they still apply to our world today. Yeah, can you get the new world order in place in such a way that great power politics is not what dominates, but that the multilateralism for the 21st century, to use another phrase, really takes shape. I think two big challenges that we are up to against is, of course, the post-1945 system, the UN system, basically, does not work any longer. And I'm extremely concerned when one talks about the United Nations in condescending terms. There's a lot to be criticized on it. But the United Nations are a members-driven organization. They are only as good as the members want it to be. Yeah, and this is the challenge that we see in particular now. I come to where do you apply this, if we could agree on this, what I've just said. It is the Middle East. And there, the scolding about the United Nations is the biggest. And it's understandable from Israel's viewpoint, because in the United Nations, Israel is being smashed all the time. But not by the Secretary General or the Secretariat or any of the organizations, but by the member states, some of the member states, Arabs, for example, who believe that by criticizing Israel, and there are many points that are absolutely correct, and one should really be much more principled on this. But on the other hand, it's also this abuse of the Palestinian issue. This is the only issue that unites the Arab states against Israel. And this is not enough, you know? On the contrary, this is something, and it was wonderful to hear from a Jordanian viewpoint how important it is to navigate a country which is really in the thickest of problems and challenges, and it's quite successful because it is looking for, and now I come back to you, Oliver, for a practical application of peace. This is really what we need to focus on, which is not the case so far, or now, rather. It used to be the case in the when the European Union was there, but the European Union, and this is my third point, is absolutely incapable and unfit for the challenges that we are up against now. European Union is now moving from being a peace project. I mean, we always forget that in 2011, the European Union got the Peace Nobel Prize, yeah? And now the European Union is basically dysfunctional to approach the challenges that are around. So the solution for the European Union is an institutional one, and it is a reform of the governance system, and it is also the necessity to move towards stateness, unless Europe becomes a sort of, and I don't want to call it the United States of Europe because it sounds too much like US, but we'll find a name, yeah? But it needs to have a decision-making process which works. You have mentioned it, Bettina. It's far too slow, you know? The lowest common denominator. These are some of the issues, and I know I should stop now because there are too many, and I get too agitated when I speak about my own continent, about Europe, how incapable we are to really make things work.
Thank you, Wolfgang. You wanted to reply, and then I have Annika and an ambassador.
Very quickly, I want to, of course, I agree completely with you. I think Europe should look at this moment in the Middle East with intention and purpose. We are talking after October 7th and after a horrible attack of October 7th. This is a rare moment when all regional countries, Arabs and Israel, they share threat perception. This was not the case, you know, before. We have seen that on April 12th. We have seen that on October 2nd. And we just see it recently at the beginning of this month when all the Arab countries, they came together. And we, for the first time, we could see what the elusive regional security framework would look like in intercepting the Iranian attack on Israel. So this is a very rare moment. It's extremely important. They share the threat perception, but they disagree on how to respond to this threat. And this is where Europe can actually play a role in mediating between Israel and the Arab countries in how to deal with this very important issue, because this is the moment when we are reshaping the future of this region.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. So there is a concrete opening for the European Union that you see now to be active, really. Yeah. Annika, please. There's a microphone here somewhere.
Hello. Yeah. I was going to say I project sort of like the European Union.
It's okay.
I have a comment and leading on from that, a bit of a question, a bit of a devil's advocate question. My comment on this panel is that it's striking how quickly we moved away from the U.S., And just only talked about what Europe is going to do now and how Europe can and should play a greater role. So my devil's advocate question comes sort of out of a number of comments that you made. Farah, you spoke about the credibility that's taken a fatal hit. We heard about colonial history, double standards, the loss of a moral compass after 7th of October. But at the same time, Bettina, you said there are a lot of countries looking to Europe to engage. I'm wondering, is that really, is that the case? And what do they expect this engagement to look like? Are we falling into the same trap of sitting here and designing the hammer rather than looking at what is the nail and what do other countries expect from Europe and the way they engage? Farah, you gave part of the answer for the Middle East in terms of what role could Europe play? But I wonder from the perspective maybe of African countries, why would they look to Europe rather than to China or to Russia? What would make sense in terms of defining the future? Now that we're thinking about a new role for Europe, should we continue offering the same things we've always been offering? Or should we think anew and engage much more into what would be useful to those that we are indeed trying to support? Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ambassador Abakan, please.
Well, this is an interesting discussion and inspiring. And thank you to the panelists for their contributions. I think here we need to listen each other. Listen. I mean, mostly what I feel, the contradictions are getting bigger, the issues are getting more complex, and we have no time to listen to each other. I mean, we are looking at Europe because of its value system, its democracy, its institutions, its legal system. And Ambassador made it very clear, our colleague Wolfgang, European Union was a peace process for me rather than a project. I mean, runner or we are somewhat lost in projects, in transactional approaches. We need to look at each other with some type of common sense instead of transactional approach, instead of reciprocity. We have to have a dialogue. We should not let the things go to the moderator or mediator. Peace is our common value. And the professor made the point, we have to look at the world order from the perspective of peace and its structures. And at the center, I think Farah made it clear, people, protection of people, caring for people, because peace is for the people. Without people acting with geopolitical thinking interest, we won't go nowhere. I think the world order, the new world order, the ambassador made it, has to be based on the expectations of the people. Maybe we should go back to UN Charter and unbiased, we have to reactivate it. We need the UN. We need the European Union. But when we look to the Middle East, or even to Mediterranean, what I am seeing, the old conflicts with new versions, but there is an increase in the contradictions surrounding us. It's not the crisis, it's also the contradictions. So our work should have to get smoothly out of these contradictions. For example, I can take a conflict and enumerate to you 7-10 contradictions. Without removing these contradictions, you can't solve the problem. So please, in the future discussions, look at the contradictions surrounding us. It's not only global, I think, south, north, east, west. Every day, we need more transparent, plain, simple, meaningful to the people discussion about the conditions surrounding us. We are creating, we are making new projects, but at the same time, we are creating new contradictions. This is not to EU. EU is important for us. EU is a peace institution, and we need the EU as a peacemaker. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ambassador. Thank you also for reminding us that in the title even of our session, there is the term of human security. Human security is the security that impacts directly on individuals, on people. Human security has been pushed into the background a lot also by these new armed conflicts that we have seen, by this renewed recourse to armaments, to weaponization, to using guns and missiles and drones to try to solve conflicts, with huge losses of lives of civilians on all sides of the conflicts, really. Malis Stubitz, please.
Yeah, good morning. Malis Stubitz, formerly with the Land Burgenland, now with the Austrian Central Bank, and practicing also as a mediator. Thank you very much to the organizers for this wonderful first panel in this first day of the Austrian Peace Forum. Thanks to all of you for this very inspiring and thoughtful inputs and contributions. Well, 2 points, actually following those you just mentioned, Irene. I'm always puzzled when we talk about armament, military armament, and when we talk about the European Union in that context. For the first time ever, we have a commissioner for defense in the European Union. We are heading, obviously, to become, as you mentioned, a security provider, heading towards probably in a few years' time or even quicker, to a European defense union. Well, this is not the concept the European Union was established. However, I understand some of your arguments, but still I'm really puzzled about that. On the other hand, you mentioned, of course, rightfully, that the US is supporting very much right-wing parties in Europe. And coming to the homework, and you mentioned it also very openly and clearly, to do our homework when it comes to the decision-making process, the governance in the European Union, I wonder what will happen if we are not succeeding to exclude right-wing parties to become members of government, to become prime ministers, and as you rightfully mentioned, Wolfgang, United Nations is as good as its members. But if the European Union shifts more and more to the right-wing landscape, what will happen then with our armed European Union? How will be the governance look like if we have not unanimity, if we have less than qualified majority voting? So what will happen in that context? What will you envisage in that context? And will that be not an enormous threat for the whole exercise as we have set it up, the European Union as a peace project, program, a peace
initiative.
Yeah. Initiative. Well, it's more than that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maris. Ambassador Tsaki, please. You have the mic right here.
Thank you.
Upstairs?
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the panelists for a very thought-enriching discussion. Yesterday, actually, at the dinner table, we had many contributions to this very topic, and it was very enlightening, and I think it was a good preparation for this discussion today. What I'm very grateful for all the contributions that were made, and this time I'm not going to talk about the Middle East. It's a bit strange, but I would like to make one point about the economics behind this alleged drift. I think, which is, I think, is missing from the discussion. I think it is very important in discussing transatlantic relations. I know, for instance, that some givens like the United States were not very happy with the establishment of a euro currency. It's very known. Not very enthusiastic about the whole Europe getting together and forming this potential pole in international relations. That's also a given. I know that in the globalized world, the order that used to prevail for 30 years until very recently, that is now getting attacked and perhaps undermined forever, we don't know. But during those years, the United States had its own interests, and the European Union had its own interests. They had common grounds, but they did not see eye to eye on many things. So it's not really a question, it's a comment, because I don't want to take much of the time. I just want to say that looking at a transatlantic drift should include the economic element, because it is crucial to understand why the United States is acting the way it is acting in shifting away from what seems to be this alliance. I know that the topic, and everybody is interested in the peace perspective and the peace dimension of what is happening and the peace implications of what is happening and the security implications of what is happening. But I think we have to have a deeper, wider look at what is happening and why it is happening from an American perspective, and how the European Union can address those issues, whether it is able to address those issues or not. That's also an open question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Zaki, for bringing that economic dimension into the debate. I would like to give the floor to the gentleman on the balcony up there. And I'll take one more request for the floor. Yes, two more from this side. And then, unfortunately, we have to close because the time that is set for us does not allow for more discussion. I will then revert to the panel for a last short concluding reflection. Please.
First of all, thank you all for your very insightful speeches, and I have a commentary and two very short questions. So the first, the US and Europe have shown quite clearly their disregard for international law and support for political and financial gain in those recent years, thus losing their international credibility, in my opinion. So my first question is, what justification does the West have to assume the role of a mediator of peace and or the world police? And sort of suggestion is, isn't it time for the West to kind of sit down, take a breath, and reflect upon its actions in those recent years, and maybe sort of hand over the stick to other countries to pave the road for peace? There have been lots of countries who have been very keen on establishing a rule-based order, bringing back or urging lots of countries back to international law, and maybe it's a good opportunity for the West and especially the European Union to just relax a bit and think about what other things they could do in the future and sort of hand the stick to other countries. For example, like South Africa, who has been very keen to bring back the international order and human rights and international law. The second question is, we've been hearing quite lots of things, lots of talk about the defense spending of the European Union and bringing it back to bringing it up and raising it up to 5%. And my question is whether or how, by raising the percentage of the GDP for armament and weaponry, how does that pave the way for Europe to be a mediator of peace? In my opinion, if I see a person fully armored and having lots of guns and lots of kinds of weaponry, that's not the kind of person that I would go to in order to establish peace. So that's a question for the panelists, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The gentleman here, yeah, please.
So thank you. I would like first to congratulate the panelists. And my name is Boni Mpaka. I'm a humanitarian practitioner, mostly in the way of humanitarian access negotiations in complex emergencies, not only armed conflict, but also in terrorist contexts, such as in the Sahel region, but also East Africa. So I'm happy to be here, and my a small comment, or if you can consider it as a recommendation, is to build on yesterday's point from the former Minister of Defense, saying that the classic ways of dealing with the ongoing crisis, I think, has shown their limits. And I share that view. And I'm part of those thinking that, yes, the way of conflict mediation, conflict resolution, I think they need to be reviewed and adjusted to the context. This saying that to come back to what some say is that for local problems, we should be thinking for local solutions with local actors. And I'll build on further point on how either AU, either US, or United Nations, I think it will be good to put in the middle the affected people, building on the ambassador point. So we are talking about peace. I was reflecting on it since yesterday. Who needs peace? I think it's the people who are affected. And I'm coming back to my humanitarian background, saying that I think when we talk about peace, we should think about those who are in need of peace. And if we see what has been going on from either United Nations, member states, big organizations, I don't have an example where I saw in a meeting or in a panel having the affected people. Yeah. We are talking and reflecting on their behalf. And the key concern is that, unfortunately, our key counterparts are the conflict makers. But we try to use them as peacemakers. This is why I think it will be difficult to reach the point. So that is my first point. And coming on, again, with the humanitarian experience in when we try to negotiate access or to keep humanitarian space, when you have complex emergencies with the UNDPKO mission, European Deployment Mission, international regional mission, example of Mali, where I worked with, I'll keep that in my mind, with where you have the UN mission, European mission, West Africa mission, then the National Army, and then the local armed groups. So for this, the only way for humanitarian to stay and deliver was to stick on the humanitarian principles, neutrality and impartiality. But my question to the panel is to check. So in all the ongoing process, I would like to, the value we are raising, which is on which values are we focusing to ensure that, yes, we can be perceived as mediators, that we can be perceived as peacemakers. Because for humanitarian, our only point was to be neutral and impartial. We don't talk even about our donors. I remember in north of Mali, if you say that you are receiving money from Europe, then you are an enemy. So you'll be targeted. So I think that was, and the last point from the UN, I think, coming back to the complex context, I would like just to recall that the United Nations, there are a lot of issues, but when it comes to the UNDSS, there are some improvements on which, on ground, we try to build on, such as the new concept of stay and deliver. As you know, in the past, I started to work with the UN when I was finishing my university in 19, so I know what I talk about. We shifted from evacuating than stay and deliver. Try to see how you look for community acceptance than counting on the army, on the politician. The other one is about saving life together. I think this is another also a new way of working on which the humanitarian should be supported, because we shift from the UN agencies to the humanitarian community. Not only the UN agencies, but also with the international NGOs and the local NGOs. And the last one is about we don't leave nobody behind. So, and this is again coming to the values of impartiality and neutrality. Because when you are in a conflict, you must be careful on to whom are you giving the relief aid. So if it is perceived to be to one of the community in conflict, then you are a part of the conflict and you will be targeted. Thanks a lot for...
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing in the very important perspective from on the ground, from really the people that are impacted by conflict, by armed conflict, by war, by insecurity, and those people that we need to have in mind when we have our discussions. Our last speaker from the audience, please, you have the floor, madam.
Thank you very much. My name is Zara. I'm a senior social development specialist with the World Bank in Nigeria. However, I have worked with the Lake Chad Basin Commission in the Sahel and supported the creation of the multinational joint task force. I was just listening, and particularly to the relevance or irrelevance of the European Union, and just wanted to highlight that the problem with the EU is in the decision, the time it takes to make a decision. And that really has brought, you know, a lot of agitation, particularly in states that receive this aid or guidance from the European Union. So we also have the African Union. But what the African Union has that is probably a bit distinctive from the European Union is, in as much as we have the member states, we also have selected member states that aid in making the decision. So like you pointed out, Bettina, we have a group of member states that make the decision. While all member states are represented, the decisions are made by a few of those member states. And that's, then it cuts the timing. But the European Union, I can see that everyone is sitting around the prism, and it often at times takes a lot of time to bring the decision. And as the people are benefiting from this, they would rather then go to countries probably like the US or even China that makes a unilateral decision and is faster. So I thought I should just probably the time that the European Union takes to make. When the decisions finally come, I tell you they're sustainable, they're credible, they're good, but it takes a lot of time, and probably the dynamics of the conflict could have changed during the time that the decisions are being made. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's a very... very practical and very important observation as well. Now, clearly, we are not in a position to answer or to even address all the issues that were raised in this discussion. I invite you to come to the panelists bilaterally during the coffee hour and in other opportunities. I would like, however, to give the floor to the panelists for a last statement and a very brief statement. I really want to hear from each one of you the one recommendation to yourself, to take the issues we discussed forward towards more peace and justice. So what would you recommend to yourself to do to take our issues forward towards more peace and justice? Can I start with you?
Sure. One piece of advice for the region, for the Middle East, take more agency, do the heavy lifting. I think the regional countries are already doing that, but they need to do that more assertively. And following up on one of the question of the gentleman there, why not Europe, you know, just relax? Because the nature of the challenges required a collective answer. So while the region should take more authority and agency when it comes to tackling these challenges, it has to work with partners who have the expertise and the leverage in order to address these challenges once and for all.
Thank you. Wolfgang, what's the one recommendation to yourself?
Well, I would want to see a far more social Europe, in a genuine dialogue with the South, with not the global South. I think this is a misnomer. I believe those countries, civil society in particular, peace movements there, to really and seriously dialogue with them on an equal level. The inequality issue is the biggest challenge for Europe and the globe.
Yes, wonderful. Bettina, your one recommendation to yourself.
Approach what we want to do as EU in the world with humility, and at the same time bring our own house in order so that we are in a good position to listen actively what is expected from us in third countries, whether it is speedier development assistance or the kind of guidance that you sort of put to us that you would be expecting from us. So
thank
these
you.
Three things.
Oliver, what's your one recommendation to yourself?
I think as an academic, of course, I would be interested in us digging into two phenomena. One would be peace washing, that is using peace to cover geopolitics and interests, naked interests, and not referring peace back to human security or human rights and other justice-related questions, which we've heard from around the audience and the panel today. Secondly, would be to dig into these questions of complexity, speed, and the breakdown of categories that we're all very familiar and comfortable with, which you know relate to the way in which the UN system and the regional order, whether it's the EU or the AU, and to the ways in which law, international and domestic constitutional, has been constructed as forces for peace. As these categories are breaking down, we need to understand this, what's going to replace them, need to have a clearer view of that in order to preserve these basic foundations for peace and peacemaking.
Thank you. Please join me in giving a big hand to our panel. Thank you also to the audience. And let's continue our conversations.
Let's do so in the workshop room, so please make your way there now. Coffee's served there. Thank you so much for being with us and participating so actively. And I'll see you back here at 5 for our next panel. Thank you.